Well, first of all, before I begin, I would like to really thank Stan Smith over here for organizing this event and making it possible. A round of applause for Stan, really. Thank you. And I also want to thank the United Electrical Workers for also lending us this space and making it possible. Solidarity. My name is Lucas Kerner. I've lived in Venezuela for 2.5 years, working for Venezuela Analysis, doing reporting. I also am a master's student at the Institute for Advanced Studies in Caracas, and I am working a thesis on looking at an ethnography of the Venezuelan Ministry of Communes and, you know, looking at bureaucracy and revolutionary transition. And I'm happy to answer questions about that later. But I think I'll just dive right in because we have limited time. So I think I wanted to really begin with the election result on this past Sunday for people who, you know, haven't seen that there was National Constituent Assembly elections in which a stunning 8 million people turned out to vote amid a campaign that can only really just be described as terror, a terror campaign in many ways that could be a construction similar to that you see in the Dixie South, and a campaign of intimidation, a campaign of attacking 200 voting centers, of a candidate was killed the night before the election, etc. And despite all of this, you had a very significant turnout. 41.5% of the population turned out to vote. And, you know, of course, what is the reaction to this? It's a stepped-up campaign of regime change. And most particularly, it's this attempt to delegitimize this election as a fraud. You know, of course, you know, this all comes as anyone who follows Venezuela, this is very familiar. The opposition and the United States, you know, supported by the United States, financed and, you know, logistically aided by the United States, has cried fraud for the last 18 years and has refused to recognize every election except for the ones they win, of course. But in this particular election, you know, we saw immediately, you know, we'll discuss this later, but we saw that the electronic data management company for the election, Smartmatic, has came out saying that, oh, the vote is off by 1 million, and then a New York-based investment bank says, oh, it's actually off by 4 million, and then another, you know, they can't even get their numbers right for attempting to claim that this is not a legitimate poll. But I think that before we talk about the Constituent Assembly and the last few months of really this opposition insurrection that we've been living through in Venezuela, I really want to kind of go back and give a little bit of context about really how we've gotten to this point. And, you know, this really international rejection of the election result by Washington, by Madrid, by all of the U.S.'s lapdogs, you know, and puppet governments in Latin America, Argentina, Mexico, and, you know, various others. You know, it reminds us of 4 years ago when Nicolas Maduro was elected president, tight margin. It was not that tight, actually. He actually won by a larger margin than Bush allegedly, you know, that actually won the 2000 election in the United States was close. And, you know, right upon that, following the death of Chavez, you know, the opposition also really inaugurated what we're seeing today is this, you know, violent insurrectionary strategy in which basically the opposition refused to recognize the result of that election, in which it was recognized almost every government in the world and every international observation body recognized as legitimate. The presidential candidate, with the aval of the United States, called for his supporters to vent their anger in the streets, and 11 people were killed. And in fact, I think it was at least 6 months before Washington actually, or more, before Washington recognized the Maduro government. Maduro was a legitimately elected president. So this is, again, all very familiar. But how do we get to this point? That's really the question. The roots of this current crisis that we're living through in Venezuela, you know, begins with, you know, two crises. Really, the first is the death of former President Hugo Chavez, who really was, you know, a giant, and who really was arguably in Venezuela, the grassroots sectors, the social movements, they call him the infiltrado, the infiltrator within the state. That he was a, you know, basically an agent on the part of the masses of people within the state apparatus who was, you know, attempting to lead forward transformations, revolutionary transformations. And he was basically a transmission channel between the demands of the people to the, you know, the high government and the party. And his death meant that the top government and the party leaders basically became isolated from their popular bases. And it kind of accelerated this existing process of bureaucratic decay and corrosion that was already underway. And it's a legitimacy crisis. The legitimacy crisis begins with the death of Chavez, unfortunately. And then the other key event that almost simultaneously is you have the collapse of global oil prices, which in 2013 were $100 a barrel. And you have a 75% decline beginning in late 2014, hitting a low of $20 a barrel in January 2016, which is, for a country that depends at its height, 96% of its export earnings on oil, this is an incredibly devastating blow to the country, together with the loss of its leader, and really the symbol of the process of revolutionary transformation in many ways. So, the death of Chavez really means, it's a crisis of hegemony within the state, and it means that there's a paralysis, that there's, and as a result, there's a failure on the part of the government to take any substantive economic measures for 2 years, in the face of declining oil prices, and what you're beginning to see is a process of inflation is beginning to spiral out of control. You're starting to see shortages of the price control system is beginning to break down, in which basically the government would fix the price of important key products for the masses of people so that they could afford them, for example, like corn flour. These products would disappear because as part of a kind of a planned strategy on the part of these, it wasn't all necessarily political. It was partly just rational economic activity that instead of selling these products at the fixed price, the price control, they're going to hoard them and wait for the controls to be lifted or take them to Colombia and sell them at international prices. So this is kind of what you begin to, you have this, the post-election violence in 2013. And then, basically you have the situation in which the popular masses of people cannot, the social movements, they cannot push forward. They don't have the hegemony within the state to push forward the process of transformation, but also those kind of bully bourgeois elements, those capitalist elements that had temporarily allied with Chavez, they were not yet strong enough to impose a total thermidor kind of counter-revolutionary restoration. So, Gramsci terms this kind of moment a catastrophic impasse in which no power can impose itself and, basically just it's chaos. And that's kind of what we've been living through for the last 3 years. So in the midst of this government paralysis, the opposition steps up its insurrectionary strategy. And this is with the 2014 campaign known as The Exit. And it's really, they start utilizing this, it's called these guarimba tactic. Guarimbas are violent street barricades where they close down a street and basically with burning trash or rubble or cut down trees or whatever. And these are enforced with firearms or other weapons. Anyone attempts to remove them could be hurt or killed. And these close down large sections of the middle class and upper middle class communities of the country. They said this is a upper middle class revolt against the government. That the class character of this cannot be emphasized enough. And 43 people are killed in this episode. The majority of them, Venezuela analysis documented at the time, were government supporters, security personnel, and passerby. Contrary to the media narrative at that point. So what we see is this kind of this twin crisis of this economic crisis and this legitimacy crisis, they reach this apex and they further deepen with the 2015 National Assembly elections, in which the opposition wins a landslide victory. And we should note that the opposition was crying fraud up until their victory. To the night of the victory, they were claiming that it was a fraud. And, in fact, the United States, Hillary Clinton actually, in the campaign trail multiple times, she said, oh, this is going to be a fraud. Luis Almagro, the head of the Organization of American States, also spoke out claiming it was going to be a fraud. And then, of course, once it's over, Venezuela is miraculously, rebranded as a democracy because the opposition won. So this is kind of the way things work. But you all probably know this. Anyway, so the victory of the opposition kind of inaugurates a new strategy on the part of the opposition. It's a kind of a Trojan horse strategy within the state or apparatus, in which basically they're using the parliament as a battering ram to overturn the Bolivarian institutional order that has been crafted over the past 16, 17 years at that time. So basically, the moment they're inaugurated, again, this is contrary to anything you will read, for example, even in Nakhla, but in most mainstream media and even center-left publications who claim that, oh, the National Assembly has been stifled by the government, that this is some kind of authoritarian, this is omitted from this narrative, that the moment the opposition is inaugurated, they declare, Henry Ramos Ayew declares, I think it's like January 6, 2016, that they're going to remove Bonoro within 6 months. Of course, this is totally unconstitutional because, to have a recall referendum, which Venezuela does have, you need at least 8 months or more. So then they pass counter-revolutionary legislation, the amnesty law, which basically, declares a whole part of the criminal code. They just rip it out and say all these crimes are pardoned and in order to release their own activists. A whole list of crimes of people basically engaged in insurrection against the government and, military rebellion and homicide and, even drug trafficking, all kinds of things. So also there's a housing law. They seek to privatize the entire government-built housing program, the Misión Vivienda, which has built 1.7 million homes to date. And that was, and then also a national production law that was going to return all of the expropriated assets to their owners, and which would really affect communes and other cooperatives. So these are all struck down by the Supreme Court. And then you also see that the opposition tries to do the recall referendum, as you saw in mainstream media. However, they self-sabotage because they began it too late. And to do it, you need at least 8 months. And if you don't do it before January 10th, 2017, earlier this year, then Maduro can't be ousted. He can be ousted, but his vice president will take his place. So basically, they started it late on purpose because not on purpose, but they couldn't decide on which strategy they wanted to do because they thought that they could, that they could pass a constitutional amendment to shorten his term retroactively and all kinds of things that were just completely, half-baked and would not work. But they, they're more radical elements. Wanted to do that, but the ultimate the sad thing is that even that and they ultimately, although they failed to do the recall referendum because they self-sabotage, ultimately they had a secondary they dealt collateral damage in the sense that they kind of all of these kind of tactics, all of these efforts served to kind of batter down and tarnish the government's democratic legitimacy, and this is really dangerous in that sense. But I mean, they also tried to do things like declare that Maduro had abandoned his post earlier this year and late last year, which is they attempted to show that he was Colombian. He was a Colombian citizen and couldn't serve. I mean, this is just the lengths that they went, which is ridiculous. But anyway, the point is the government responds to all this with a kind of like a top-down maneuvering, that they use the Supreme Court to like strike down all this legislation, as I mentioned. They also pass an emergency economic decree where they give the executive power to pass all kinds of decrees, which actually the government doesn't really use because Maduro doesn't approve any substantive economic measures anyway, but whatever, they approve that. And they basically kind of end up, they attempt to quarantine the National Assembly so it can't continue to attempt the parliamentary coup that it's attempting to carry out, because that's what the National Assembly has been trying to do. So, and this ultimately, the result of this is, basically this strategy is actually counterproductive in the sense that it does not, by further, maneuvering from above, the government, instead of mobilizing the people from below, this actually contributes to this effort to delegitimize Venezuela's democratic, credentials, to tarnish that, and it plays in the opposition's hands in a certain sense, even if it stops the opposition from, for example, ousting the president. So, I mean, that's kind of the dangerous, aspect of the situation, that we're in. And in this sense, in this context in which basically the opposition has failed to oust the president through, a parliamentary coup, the Guarimbas didn't work in 2014, and all this the recall referendum, they self-sabotage, and the CNE, this electoral authority, also dragged its feet. Basically, in this moment in which the international correlation of forces changes in January 2017, the Trump administration is elected in the United States. You also have, before you have the coup in Brazil in May 2016, which is a key U.S. ally, key Venezuelan ally, and Dilma Rousseff is ousted. And then you also have the election of Mauricio Macri, a right-wing a neoliberal in Argentina, who is also, the fall in where there was once a close, leftist administration, close ally in Cristina Kirchner. So these factors basically lead the opposition to think that, well, they can try the violent insurrectionary strategy once again. And this begins around in April. So the pretext for this, of course, that they seize upon this is a March 28th Supreme Court ruling, which, you know, to spare you the details, basically the Supreme Court authorizes the judiciary to, this is the what you saw in the headlines, Venezuela dissolves the National Assembly. This is like what you saw. Actually, this is what happened. That they basically just, they didn't dissolve the National Assembly. The National Assembly has been in contempt of court, so it's been just null and void since, you know, last year. Basically because they refused to unseat three deputies who were accused of voter fraud. And this is totally, you know, politically motivated because they could easily unseat them and continue to pass legislation, but they are not interested in governing. They're interested in trying to overthrow the government and doing anything they can to create ingovernability and tarnish the image of the government's democratic legitimacy. So they refused to unseat these deputies. And, you know, the Supreme, the National Assembly, the parliament continues to be there. So it, basically, in the situation in which the parliament is not governing, they're trying to overthrow the government, you know, they're trying to say the president has abandoned his post, all of this, there's a key problem because the parliament has to approve legislation, for example, to merge, to create new joint ventures in the oil sector, to, you know, agreements with Russia and China to develop oil so the government can have revenue, all of that. They can't do that without the National Assembly. So then, anyway, this are all a lot of details. I don't want to bore people with this. The point is that the opposition seizes upon this ruling, you know, it makes a big deal of it. These rulings get reversed by the very Supreme Court at the behest of the Attorney General, who says that it's a constitutional rupture, and this is the beginning of the rupture between the Attorney General and the government. And, you know, she basically, the Supreme Court rolls back on this, and that's the point. This ultimately, but nonetheless, the opposition is not satisfied, because the opposition is never satisfied until the government is overthrown. So the opposition beginning, if this happens on March 28th, the opposition takes to the streets on April 4th. And then suddenly their demands start to, like, you know, radically change day by day, because they begin protesting and they say that they want the Supreme Court judges to be removed for passing this ruling, which was reversed. And then on April 9th, but they also say they want regional elections because Venezuela had postponed its regional elections from November last year to this December, you know, which they claim, the government claims that it was due to the fact that there was the recall referendum, which, you know, ended up being, you know, for, like I said before, it was too late to begin to have the recall referendum. Regardless, the point is that Maduro on April 9th announces that the elections are going to be held in December. And suddenly that, of course, just, you know, catches the opposition with their pants down because one of their demands has just been met. So the opposition has to reposition itself and say, oh, actually, we don't really care about regional elections. Our regional elections are necessary, in Freddy Guevara's words, but not sufficient. And he says that actually we want general elections. So we want early presidential elections, in other words. So it's the same thing as 2014 because also in 2014, the opposition was saying, we want the exit of Maduro, even though he had just been elected, in a certain sense. And in fact, there's a hashtag that trends at that time on Twitter, elecciones no libertad sí, or no elections, freedom. So they're explicitly saying that they don't want elections, that they want to topple the government. So if there's any doubts about their democratic aims. So kind of moving on to the question of the actual nature of the protests that we've seen, that the tactics that we've been seeing are largely the same as 2014, in which they involve this, you know, closing down highways, closing down streets with, you know, these violent barricades, provoking clashes with security personnel on purpose, for example, marching. You know, the government has not permitted marches to the western part of Caracas, where the presidential palace is, basically where the White House is, since 2002, because in 2002 there was a march by the opposition that got diverted, and they said, suddenly, we're going to march in the presidential palace, which in any other country, of course, would be, you'd have, you know, a legion of, you know, of security personnel to block them from doing that. But in Venezuela, this basically, they marched, and you had an incident where police snipers actually opened fire on both sides, and these police were aligned with the opposition, and this was the opening for the coup that was backed by the United States. So the government has prohibited the opposition from marching to the west since then, but the opposition continually, like today, attempts to do so in order to provoke clashes, in order to say that the government is a dictatorship that doesn't let people march in the streets, even though in any other country in the world this would not be acceptable. Also, another tactic that you see is that the opposition targets anyone who's perceived to be a Chavista for violence. It also targets public infrastructure, government institutions, and particularly soft targets like health clinics and food distribution centers. And we can see key examples of this. For example, in Anzoátegui in the east, you had a government warehouse on June 29th that filled with 50 tons of food that was torched. Completely. You see the besieging of maternity hospitals in El Valle on April 20th and Los Teques on May 17th. You see the Supreme Court Executive Office in the east of the city in Chacao was attacked four times in 70 days, to the point that they moved it out of the park. They said, we're not going to use this building anymore because it's too much of a danger to the 2,000 people who are working there. So they've attacked military facilities like the La Carlota Air Force Base in the eastern Caracas, or Mortar Garrison in Thatcher, and any other place. If you attack a military facility in the United States, I guarantee you, you will be probably dead, before you attempt anything, But in Venezuela, almost nothing happens. So of course, the mainstream media has been essential. All this has provided ideological air cover in a certain way for these terrorist actions. And I think we should not call them protests. I don't like to use the term terrorists, but I think they are terror actions. The mainstream media has sought to present all of these incidents as the result of repression by the government. So the government provoked it, or within that, every death as the victim of security forces, either implied or explicitly stated. Now, of course, the reality, as is often the case, is very different. Venezuelan analysis has been running a daily death count since the beginning of this. And we have found that of the 126 people who have been killed, in fact, of those whom we know for sure the cause of death, or we know with a lot of confidence, that the majority of the victims are victims of opposition political violence. We have 23 victims of people killed by the opposition. For example, you have the assassination of two candidates to the National Constituent Assembly, one on the eve of the vote and another a few weeks on July 10th, something that you will never see reported in the media. You have the killing of a, we're in a labor hall, of a worker labor leader of a worker-owned factory in Bolívar, Rexol Acevedo, who is gunned down in a barricade. You have lynchings. You have the Orlando Figueroa, who's an Afro-Venezuelan man, 21-year-old, in the east of Caracas. He is accused of being a thief or a chavista, depending on your account, and he is stabbed six times, doused in gasoline, and set on fire, and while people watch him burn, and he dies, I think, a week later in the hospital. I mean, it's not just the people who did this to him, it's the lynch mob who watched and, who enjoyed it and partook in this exercise. Or other case, Jose Subero was a National Guard lieutenant who was at a funeral for a protester, and he was accused of being an infiltrator, i.e. a chavista, and he was also swarmed by a mob of people, and he was killed. So, I can keep going looking for questions, but these are hate crimes in every sense, and these are things that, and also you see cases just people being indiscriminately killed at barricades for no particular reason, not necessarily because they're chavista. 10 minutes from my house, for example, in El Paraíso, in western Caracas, there was a basically this man, Oliver Villacamargo, just a businessman. He was driving past a barricade in his car, and he was stopped. And basically, because he went through the barricade, a motorcycle came up beside him with two opposition people, and they shot him in the face, and he died. And this is a judge was also killed in the same neighborhood. In fact, the very judge who had denied Leopoldo Lopez, who was a Venezuelan opposition leader, who was led the 2014 violence that I mentioned before. This judge was actually killed at a barricade in El Paraíso as well. I think that was in June. So I mean, this is also you just have cases in which it's just even indirect. It's not even the direct result of someone shooting you. It's this Olympic swimmer, Angel Moreira. He was killed. There was a blockade on the highway. So another motorcycle had to turn around, and he was going the same way, and they crashed, and he died. We have numerous cases of this. So I mean, this is the kind of situation of terror that people in Venezuela are being forced to live by the opposition. And in many ways, this explains the election result, because people were not necessarily voting for the government. People were also voting against this situation of violence and terror that they're being forced to live in. That even the conservative data analysis pollster finds that these kinds of tactics are opposed by over 60% of the population. I've seen other polls that say 80%. So, I mean, there's no support for these kinds of violent tactics that just make everyone's life miserable and deadly. Even the middle class people who can't you know, leave their community. You know, for example, I have one of my, where I observe at the ministry, one of my one of the workers there, she lives in a middle class neighborhood in Eastern Caracas, and she was worried about how she was going to leave on Saturday, because she couldn't leave her community on Sunday to vote, because basically they were saying anyone who leaves the community, who attempts to go outside their house, is a traitor, and anything can happen to them. So she had to go stay somewhere else Saturday night so that she could go to a different voting center, because the government had created this contingency plan where you can vote in different voting centers. And you know, the workers, you know, if you're a Chavista, it is a scary time to be a Chavista in Venezuela. She was saying that in her neighborhood someone had saw her with a shirt from the Ministry of Communes, and someone had threw a flower pot from a building at her, and it nearly hit her. You know, this is serious, because Almelina Carrillo, who was a woman who was just a nurse, and she was on her way on April 19th to her work. She was passing through the government, pro-government march in central Caracas, and someone threw a frozen water bottle from the building, and it hit her in the head, and she died that very week. She died, I think, a week later. And, you know, this is, I mean, clearly an intentional act, and it's captured on video. This was an effort to, you know, this is political violence. That's what this is. And this is, you know, there's complete, you know, this is completely, you know, you don't hear about any of this on the mainstream media at all. And in terms of, I think I was going to make another point about that. Okay, whatever. In terms of moving on to, like, the nature of these protests is, I would say that while you do see that the protests, like in 2014, are largely concentrated, the epicenter of these protests are middle-class areas, such as Eastern Caracas, north of Valencia, parts of Mérida. Nonetheless, you do see that, and this is evidenced by the fact that the opposition multiple times has called for a general strike. For example, last week, Wednesday and Thursday, were supposed to be a general strike, though it was hardly general in a large sense of the term, that it was outside of these middle-class enclaves. No one knew there was anything going on. I mean, because obviously to have a strike, as everyone knows here, you need to have support from the workers and from the popular sectors, which the opposition does not have. So, I mean, a key difference here from 2014 is that the economic crisis is very deep. And as a result, the opposition has been able to channel popular discontent in the form of lootings and kind of like the mobilization of what, you know, we might term, which I don't like, but lumpen proletariat, in kind of traditionally Chavista areas such as the south and southwestern Caracas, Barinas, the Barinas state, Maracay, and other parts of Lara state. And, you know, this is also due to the fact that, like, in these areas, the mayors and the governors who are largely opposition have been completely complicit with the protests, which is, you know, would be unheard of. You know, it'd be like the mayors of Alexandria, and the outskirts of Washington, D.C., all of these municipalities, you know, deciding that they were going to, like, you know, support, you know, basically anti-government protests spent on overthrowing the president, ousting the president. You know, I mean, this would be, and they would continue in their posts. I mean, this is the kind of situation that you're in. And, you know, in fact, one of my colleagues who lives in Barquisimeto in Lara State, she was saying that, you know, literally the situation was being worsened by the state government and the municipal government, because they were shutting down access to gas, or they were refusing to do maintenance work on gas and water. So people couldn't get had for weeks without gas and water, and this was just stoking the flames of discontent and pushing people to a point at which they exploded. And, you know, you saw looting for a week in Barquisimeto, and, you know, the same thing in Maracay. And finally, I mean, the government is beginning to take action and actually is arresting some of these mayors, and, you know, there's court sentences against them, and it looks like they're going to serve some time, hopefully. I mean, we'll see how that plays out. In terms of and I think it's important to emphasize here that while the principal objective of the opposition is to overthrow the government, without a doubt, that the more radical elements just want to, they want to do anything that they can provoke kind of a U.S. intervention, no matter what form it takes, to oust the government. I think that there's a secondary objective, which is more pernicious in every sense, that they're just trying to stoke in governability in order to delegitimize the government. So, and this is, the media is the key ally in this and making this possible. They're just trying to make Venezuela, you know, people are breaking into zoos and eating zoo animals, you know, situation like that. People, you know, it's like people are eating each other in Venezuela. Like this is the kind of, you know, things that you're hearing. And it's obviously, a lot of this is not true. While of course the situation is very dire in every sense. In terms of, so we come to the point in May when Maduro, in the midst of all this, is heating up with the streets by the opposition, Maduro unveils a National Constituent Assembly as kind of a solution to this current political standoff. And I'm going to get into all that, but I can just say the National Constituent Assembly is basically an assembly to rewrite the constitution. And Venezuela actually has, within its existing constitution, it specifies in many that this can be done, unlike the U.S. Constitution, which, by the way, is illegitimate because it was, you know, basically written by a room full of slave owners and merchant elites in Philadelphia who just decided unilaterally to dissolve the Articles of Confederation, which was a legitimate document that came out of the War of Independence. And, you know, as such, our current, you know, Constitution is not technically legitimate because it was not. Yet the United States feels, you know, empowered to lecture other countries on how they should redraft their constitutions. Anyway, the proposal that Maduro comes out with, it catches the opposition completely off guard. And because, in fact, the opposition for the last few years has consistently called for a National Constituent Assembly because they have zero respect for the existing constitution. Because recall that Chavez, the opposition has never recognized the 1999 constitution, only when it's convenient for them, i.e. when they win elections or they can do the recall referendum. But remember what happened in 2002, the Carmona dictatorship that was, you know, blessed by Washington, the New York Times, and Madrid, the first thing they did was they tore up the Constitution, and they actually dissolved the National Assembly, and they actually dissolved the Supreme Court and all the other constituted powers. So, and we should keep this in mind when we hear all the propaganda about, you know, what the Maduro government is doing. So, of course, although this definitely catches the opposition off guard, it does have the effect of further dividing some of government supporters, because you have some prominent Chavistas who do oppose the Constituent Assembly, and you have the Attorney General Luisa Ortega, who had, as I mentioned before, very quickly that she had broken with the government over these rulings by the Supreme Court over, you know, the Supreme Court being able to legislate and all that. She comes out and she says she refuses to. Basically say, I don't support the Constituent Assembly, but she begins to radicalize her own demands, and she begins to take up the opposition's kind of talking points and the opposition's demands, and she calls for the removal of the Supreme Court justices, she calls for the suspension of the Constituent Assembly, she condemns the government's repression of protests without actually acknowledging the opposition violence, she begins to just come out with, act as judge, jury, claiming to be both the judge and the jury, wherein she's just the prosecutor, saying that, you know, these people were definitely killed by the government, when in fact, you know, only a court can decide that. So, I mean, we can get into that later, but this is definitely a key moment right here. So, coming as of a month ago, earlier, we see the opposition, you know, goes into overdrive in an attempt to stop the Constituent Assembly. So it convokes what is called a plebiscite. You know, and Venezuela has no procedure to have a plebiscite. You can have a referendum through the Constitution, but they say, all right, we're just going to have this outside of the Constitution without the electoral authority. And, you know, they say, they give people three questions. You can, do you want a Constituent Assembly, which is, you know, more or less a legitimate question. Do you want the armed forces to act to restore the Constitution? I.e., do you want a military coup in Venezuela, in other words? And then a third one, with regard to the position of other public sector of the government with regard to other issues. So basically, of course, the opposition's own body that was observing this, it came out and said that, you know, they're a team of international observers, and their report said that this plebiscite was marred by numerous irregularities, including a lack of a secret ballot and multiple voting. Oh, okay. So that we can take this seriously. But they claimed, and they actually burnt the ballots afterwards. But nonetheless, the mainstream media hails this as a mandate. The Venezuelan people have spoken against Maduro's dictatorship, against the Constituent Assembly, all of the usual. But not only that, they say that, oh, this is a mandate to step up the protest, because this is not, they call it zero hour. You know, this is not a video game, this is not Call of Duty or whatever, this is Venezuela. They're saying that they're gonna basically, literally, this is the words that they're using, they're going to provoke ungovernability until the government falls. And as I said before, they had a 48-hour strike last week. which was largely unsuccessful. Nonetheless, 7 people were killed. And then Washington also begins to step up its pressure on Venezuela. So you have Washington, 13 top Venezuelan officials are sanctioned by the United States. And then Trump also vows strong and swift economic actions against Venezuela if it goes ahead with the Constituent Assembly, i.e. basically refusing to buy or embargoing Venezuela oil exports to the United States, which Venezuela oil is the number 3 oil import to the United States. So clearly it would be a huge blow to Venezuela, also to the United States. But nonetheless, so you have this mounting international pressure from the United States. You have the mounting violence in the lead up to this election on Sunday, on July 30th. And then on the eve of the election, as I mentioned before, this child's rights activist, Felix Pineda, who's a candidate for the ANC in Bolivar State, he's assassinated in his home. On the day of the vote, you have 200 voting centers that are attacked. In fact, they're actually redoing the elections in one municipality in Táchira and one in Mérida because they couldn't make it to the vote. They couldn't make it due to the blockades and the intimidation that was going on. A roadside bomb is exploded in eastern Caracas and Altamira. In fact, the video is quite shocking if you've seen it. We have covered it on Venezuela Analysis. As onlookers cheer. I mean, they're cheering as these, basically there's this police caravan that's going, for those who haven't seen it, they're going down the street, and then suddenly this bomb, you would think this was like Iraq or Syria, and literally just engulfs these police officers, and fortunately none of them were killed. And you see the people in the background are cheering what had just taken place. And, in fact, this also, even the cases of anti-government violence are taken by the mainstream media and distorted and used to indict the government, because all of the front pages of Spanish newspapers the next day had the image of that bomb going off in front of the police, but saying government repression. And I mean, this is a clear case study in that. 10 people were killed across the country, including 1 National Guards person, 9 other people who were killed in various situations, which we still don't have the answers on and are very unclear. A number of people were probably killed by security forces in the context of protests and violent clashes. And obviously, I think that in any case of protesters being killed, there should be an investigation, and those killed should be, those who are participating in these kinds of abuses should be face trial. And in fact, in the case of 13 people, 13 protesters killed by the government, confirmed, the Venezuela Analysis has tabulated, there have been indictments in all those cases. And we'd like to see, all cases in which protesters have been killed, we'd like to see those responsible brought to justice. I mean, that's obviously unacceptable. I mean, state repression is not okay. But neither is, violent, insurrection and terror. In terms of I just want to go back and emphasize this point, that despite this, campaign of terror and the lead up to, these immense obstacles were put up for people to vote through the barricades. I mean, you have images of people crossing rivers in Táchira State on the border with Colombia to try to vote. I mean, you have this image of a 100-year-old woman being carried up the stairs in order to be able to vote. So I think that these are obviously the images that are censored by the mainstream media. But despite all of these obstacles and this violence, you have a massive turnout. And I think I want to emphasize that not only is the 8 million figure larger than the number of people who voted for Nicolas Maduro in 2013, but it's also a higher turnout than the referendum, basically the previous referendum to consult the people in 1999 if they wanted to have a constitutional change, if they wanted to rewrite the Constitution, because 36% of the population participated in that, saying that they wanted to. Obviously, over 80% said yes, but of that, only 36% of the population participated. This 41.5% of the population. So arguably, this is more legitimate in every sense. Obviously, there have been a lot of allegations that this vote has been marred by irregularities or has been rigged, and we can discuss that in the question and answer. I don't think that they carry a lot of weight, but I think it can be worth discussing. In terms of right after the vote, I mean, I think that it's interesting that if the opposition claimed that this National Constituent Assembly basically, if they're a minority in the country, and this National Constituent Assembly has no weight, or the government is a dictatorship, and the opposition is a minority, then why are they so afraid of it? And why did they go to such lengths to prevent people from voting? I think that question should, be pondered. And why is the United States so intent upon, you know, basically interfering in another country's election, you know, while at the same time it denounces, you know, looking for Kremlin stooges everywhere? This popular victory on Sunday, on July 30th, is evidenced by the response that immediately the economic, media, and diplomatic warfare is stepped up, you know, 1,000%, literally. In the case, for example, the black market rate spikes from 10,000 bolivares, you know, beforehand to 18,000 bolivares now. It's been going through the roof, and this is clearly political. There's no doubt about this. There's no rational economic reason for the exchange rate to be spiking in this way. Likewise, the U.S. predictably, as I mentioned before, refuses to recognize the result, and the Treasury Department sanctions Nicolas Maduro. However, notably, the United States does not go ahead with the economic sanctions, which is interesting. And then the international media also goes on the offensive as to cast this as a dictatorial power grab, as we've already mentioned. So basically, that being said, I think I'm going to talk a few more minutes about what the National Constituent Assembly is, because I think that's unclear for a lot of people. So what is it? Basically, it's a citizens' assembly. It's composed of 545 delegates who have been elected by direct secret ballot. And, you know, any citizen was able to present themselves as a candidate. There's 364 territorial delegates. That is, every municipality in the country elects one, and everyone that's a state capital elects two. And there's 8 indigenous representatives who were chosen on Tuesday according to their own traditions and, you know, mechanisms. And there's a 173 sectoral delegates. And this is the really interesting part, because these are different sectors of the population: workers, campesinos or farmers and fishermen, people with disabilities, students, pensioners, the business sector, communes, and communal councils, who get to elect their own representatives to draft legislate, to basically participate in this process, which is a very novel feature, because in the 1999 process, this was not there. And of course, like, the media has consistently said that, you know, in opposition, that Maduro doesn't have the power to call Constituent Assembly. I mean, this is not true. In Article 348 of the Constitution, the President, the National Assembly, or a percentage, or the people, by collecting signatures, can trigger this process. And, you know, there's a whole controversy over whether or not this has to be approved by had to be a private referendum to approve this or not. We can discuss that later. But the point is, Maduro has said that there will be a referendum at the end of this process to approve the ultimate document, the Magna Carta, that comes out of it. So regardless, the people are going to have to vote on whether or not they agree with the changes, period. And, you know, so if the opposition doesn't like it, they can vote against it. And that's something that's continually omitted from mainstream media accounts. And I think that Maduro has outlined a number of areas in which he's proposals for areas for constitutional changes. And those areas are the nation's right and need for peace, improvements to the country's economy, the constitutional recognition of the missions. The missions are basically parallel structures that Chavez created in order to address pressing social needs. For example, the Barrio Adentro mission is like Cuban-Venezuela mission, the Cuban and Venezuelan physicians in small clinics throughout the country providing free health care. So you have, you know, basically the government wants to have, you know, there's a push for the part of the grassroots, particularly, to recognize these missions as, you know, part of the Constitution, so the opposition can't just eliminate them when they come to power, because it's a real concern. In terms also an extension of the justice system's scope, kind of to end impunity for crimes, because I mentioned before there's a situation of impunity in Venezuela towards right-wing violence, and it's quite serious. The also constitutional recognition of new forms of popular democracy, for example, the communes and the communal councils, which the opposition would likely, one of the first things they would do would be to eliminate these institutions and eliminate the Ministry of Communes, where I do research. The workers have stressed that. the defense of Venezuela's sovereignty and protection against foreign intervention, which is obviously important, reinvigorating Venezuela, the plural, multicultural character of Venezuela, and also, lastly, a guarantee for the future of Venezuela's youth through enshrining in the Constitution their rights and the need to preserve the life of the planet. Now, within these areas, there's been a number of interesting proposals to make constitutional changes, and I'm going to present a few of them before I close. That, you know, for example, proposal to modify Article 113 of the Constitution so that not only is there a prohibition against monopolies, but also against oligopolies. So, for example, Polar, which is the largest food company in the country, which is basically an oligopoly and has the country by the ball, so to speak, in terms of food production, and has been refusing to produce despite receiving money from the government, they could be broken up, perhaps, or expropriated. Hopefully, the government will take action on that front. Also legislation against hate crime legislation, a proposal to treat corruption as a crime against the state and punish it severely in the framework of human rights guarantees. And I think that that's also very key. Also, proposals to a proposal to freeze prices of basic goods. And I think that another thing that's important to recognize that I'm going to close with is that within one other reason for the massive turnout that you saw last Sunday was that the opposition boycotted the elections. And what did this mean? It meant that instead of all of the social movements and the popular movements having to close ranks behind the PSUV, the ruling Socialist Party candidates, and who were handpicked by the bureaucracy in many cases, they could field their own candidates against the bureaucratic candidates. And they, in fact, in a number of cases, not enough, these popular movements, and it was called Chavismo Bravío, or fierce Chavismo, or defiant Chavismo, that these candidates actually won out. And you have people like Ángel Prada, who is from the Comuna El Maizal, which is one of the largest communes in the country and has very significant production capacities in Lara State. And he's calling to transfer unproductive state and private factories to productive communes, and also to increase the workers' control in state enterprises. Or you have José Luis Valera, who is also from a large commune called the Comuna Eterno Gigante, or the Eternal Giant Commune. And he's calling for campesinos and communes to be given preference in the state's distribution of fertilizers and seeds, because basically, as of now, the state just gives all these seeds to private, or gives them to private companies, or sells them at subsidized rates to private companies, and then they get sold to the campesinos. And obviously, this is a really bad system. He's also called for justice and protection for campesinos assassinated by landowners, because you've seen over 300 campesinos who have been assassinated in Venezuela over the past few years, because people should know that the vast majority of land in Venezuela is privately owned. It's one of the largest concentrations of private land on the continent, I think, and it's extreme problem for attempting to develop agriculture. And any attempt to really make Venezuela self-sustainable in terms of food production needs to go about challenging the oligarchy and the landed oligarchy. Also, another leader, for example, Vanessa Mortero, who is a student leader and a Communist Party youth activist from Lara, she is calling to guarantee the rights of student mothers to maternity leave, childcare, breastfeeding, the right to choose gender identity, which is very radical, and as well as anti-discrimination laws. Jose Novoa, who is a Bolivarian Socialist Federation of Workers leader, he is calling to change speaking of food sovereignty, to change the concept of food security to food sovereignty in order to make it much stronger. And basically also another change to prevent PDVSA subsidiaries from being privately, their shares from being privately owned, which could be used to basically privatize the country's oil. And also to accelerate the transfer of occupied factories to communes and workers. I mean, we saw last year that the Kelly Clark factory in Venezuela, Maduro approved the workers took it over, and Maduro gave them support and gave them raw materials to produce there. And they've actually been developing pretty significant production and very, very needed personal care products like toilet paper, like sanitary pads, all kinds of things. I mean, this is one example. This is an emblematic example, but this is symbolic, and it's not enough. It needs to be expanded. These examples need to be spread throughout Venezuela. And then finally, Miguel Chincho Medina, who is a campesino. He is also from a commune, the Socialist Pan-American Commune, and he's calling for the communal parliament to have real powers. So, I mean, in this case, I'm fine with dissolving the National Assembly, but make a communal parliament that will have, this is kind of what he's saying, what a lot of people are saying in the left, but have a grassroots parliament that has real powers. Let's not defend the bourgeois institutionality. Let's not stop there. Let's actually create alternative institutions, grassroots institutions that can push forward the process of transformation. So there's a number of questions, a lot up for debate now that this has happened. In fact, today, the National Constituent Assembly was just inaugurated in Caracas. Delcy Rodriguez, who's the former foreign minister, is now the president, which is, I think, is significant that you have, you know, a woman as the president of this body, which is now the most powerful body in Venezuela because it embodies it directly embodies the will of the people as opposed to, you know, the other institutions, the other branches of government that are constituted powers. They're representative. This is, you know, supposed to be direct embodiment in that sense. So it's significant that she is the president and she has a long, you know, trajectory as a socialist, you know, activist. And then, you know, Aristóbulo Iturriz, who is the former vice president, who is a very, also very prominent Afro-Venezuelan leader in Venezuela, he is the first vice president of this body. So, I mean, it's important to recognize that I don't want to fetishize, you know, identity here, but it's important to recognize that this matters, that, you know, for the opposition, you know, they never... Part of the reason why they never recognized the Bolivarian government was not only the fact that it was pushing through, challenging their power, the power of the oligarchy, but because, you know, as they continually reminded, you know, Chavistas and, you know, anyone, that because Chavez is negro, because Chavez is Indio, because he's sucio, he's dirty, he's an Indian, he's black. And this is something that they could never tolerate, that they're, you know, I think there's a phenomenon similar to the fact that the Republicans in this country, Sanchez, could never tolerate Obama as their president. Though it's very different because Obama was not attempting to carry out a socialist revolution and Chavez was. So that makes made the antagonism so much sharper. There's a big debate that's going to happen is, well, what is going to be the status of the Constituent Assembly with regard to the other branches of government that already exist? You know, how is it going to, is this assembly just going to close its doors for the next 6 months and write a constitution? It'll be a referendum. Or is it going to act effectively as a super parliament that can legislate and, you know, attempt to resolve the country's issues? I mean, obviously, the attempt to do so is going to be, you know, critiqued, is going to be lambasted as dictatorial. I mean, we know that. I think the real question is, what will it do? It seems like it's going to assume those powers, and will it assume those powers in a progressive or radical way to resolve the crisis on the terms of the interests of the vast majority of the population of trying to deepen revolutionary transformations, or will it attempt to compromise with the oligarchy? So, you know, Maduro has already called for the first task of this body is to immediately restructure the public prosecution, the Attorney General's office, and basically, because the Attorney General has basically refused to prosecute violent, you know, basically these violent opposition militants who are engaged in all these activities that I've mentioned. And she's basically been letting them go systematically. And the government, which I don't agree with, but you have to recognize, it has been forced to use military tribunals to process many of these people. And, you know, I think that is not, you know, a way to solve this problem. But, you know, clearly Maduro recognizes that that's not sustainable, and they need to immediately restructure this institution to make it work correctly, and they can actually guarantee due process in Venezuela. And I think it's also important that the mainstream media has talked a lot about, that this Constituent Assembly is going to suddenly just nullify all the elections. There's not going to be elections because there's a Constituent Assembly, and that's actually not true because Maduro has continually stressed that December, the regional elections in December will go ahead, rain or shine. And also the presidential elections, which probably will be held in December 2018, next year, will also go ahead. So there's no doubt about that. And in fact, one of the most important parties in the opposition, Democratic Action, its leader just announced the other day that they're going to participate in the regional elections, which is rather ironic because they're going to participate in regional elections supervised by the electoral body who they refuse to recognize and who's, you know, basically they've accused of committing a fraud in the context of the National Constituent Assembly. So it's a strange world that we're living in Venezuela. So in terms of what the first actions of the ANC might be, I think we can anticipate they're going to sign some, they're going to basically approve these mixed, these joint venture agreements with Russia and China so they can try to open up the country, you know, parts of the country to oil and mineral extraction, which is very lamentable and, you know, ugly in many ways, but the government has $11 billion in reserves and, you know, needs money in order to pay for imports. So, I mean, it should be criticized, but it should be contextualized. The government will probably, as I said, go after the public prosecution, attempt to restructure it, and they might go after it. They take away the immunity of opposition legislatures, like, for example, opposition leader Freddy Guevara, who, you know, basically has been openly calling for the government to be ousted by violent means and has been leading these protests for the past 3 months and before that. So this is kind of what we're going to see. And, you know, to close, I think that the Constituent Assembly really embodies the struggle for the soul of Chavismo in this moment. That, as I mentioned, this Chavismo Bravillo, grassroots popular movement delegates, the struggle has only begun between them and the oficialismo, as it's called in Venezuela, or the bureaucracy, the party elite who are, you know, basically, and this is not just, you know, this is not just a struggle, a mere tactical struggle. It's a fundamental, you know, it's a line struggle. It's a struggle for, you know, about what is the ultimate end? What is the horizon that we're fighting for? Are we looking for reform or revolution? Are we trying to actually make a transition to socialism? Or are we just trying to manage capitalism in a slightly more humane way? I mean, this is what is at stake here. And you know, Maduro is very ambiguous about this. I mean, the government has very much branded the National Constituent Assembly as, you know, this is the possibility for dialogue. Finally, we're going to be able to bring the opposition to the table. We'll have dialogue, and we'll have peace, and we'll be able to resolve our differences, and everything will be hunky-dory. Though, you know, obviously, this is very naive in many ways because, you know, for anyone who has been watching, you know, Venezuela for the last 18 years knows that the opposition has not for once let up in trying to overthrow the government, even if certain sectors have pacted for a moment with the government. So, I mean, it's unlikely that that while the government remains in power, the opposition will ever stop attempting to overthrow the government. Just like, you know, Dilma Rousseff implemented the global financial institutions and the, you know, the bourgeoisie's neoliberal package. She imposed austerity upon her bases and basically lost her popular support there, and they still ousted her. So I mean, no quantity of concessions are going to satiate the opposition, the U.S.-backed opposition's drive to overthrow this government and install, either through the, you know, simulacrum of democracy or, you know, through openly violent means, a oligarchic government that will impose, you know, harsh structural adjustment like you're seeing in Brazil. They just passed a constitutional amendment freezing social spending in Brazil for 20 years, something insane. And obviously, for the masses of people, this is. Social death, without a doubt. You know, when you freeze, you know, spending on medicine, as we're seeing here in this country, what, you know, privatized healthcare means for people, it's social death. So, I mean, that's evident. So, and I think that, so really what this is about, you know, this struggle between Chavismo Bravillo and, you know, oficialismo, it's this struggle for this intra-elite dialogue and peace, quote-unquote, versus radicalized class struggle. You know, in old Maoist terms, we could put it as the same philosophical debate as this: one divides into two versus two fuses into one. Are we looking to maintain antagonism and push forward towards revolutionary transition, or are we attempting to try to maintain this illusion of reconciliation and harmony, which, of course, is impossible? So I do think that, and given that this Constituent Assembly could be a strategic space for the Bolivarian left to gain visibility and accumulate forces and to push forward, and, you know, even if it's unable to necessarily pass its proposals and implement, you know, necessarily push forward with a revolutionary transition, which we'd like to see, I mean, it probably is not strong enough to do that, but nonetheless, it could use the space to accumulate forces and to strengthen its alliances, and perhaps organize in the event that the right comes to power, be better organized to confront it. The other risk, though, is that these same popular movements could be co-opted by the bureaucrats of the PSUV and, you know, their allies, and, you know, basically to neutralize any kind of further radicalization. The future is uncertain, and the only certainty that we have is that the opposition will do if it takes power, as I just mentioned. And I think that we have to embrace, you know, as the international left, we have to, you know, support. This is the strategic option taken by the Venezuelan left, the majority of the Venezuelan left, to go for the Constituent Assembly. That this is the path not taken, and we have to embrace that path, and which it could offer a revolutionary solution to the current crisis. Thank you very much. What part did the Vatican have in opposing the National Constituent Assembly? Well, the Vatican has played an interesting role in Venezuela over the past 8 months. That, in fact, if we go back to October 2016, the Vatican, actually, Pope Francis came in as a mediator for UNASUR, or the Union of South American Nations, sponsored talks between the opposition and the government, basically in an attempt, because the opposition was heating up the streets at that point and was also attempting to oust the government over its failure, basically, to meet the deadlines of the National Constituent Assembly in October, that they were unable to. They had collected over 53,000 fraudulent signatures, including 10,000 signatures belonging to deceased people, which I don't know how they managed to sign those signature rolls, but they apparently did. And so basically the Vatican, in this moment of crisis in October, the Vatican agreed to come in, in fact, opposed by the Catholic Church within Venezuela, because the Catholic Church of Venezuela is extremely pro-opposition, and they did not want the Vatican at all to try to kind of promote any kind of negotiated settlement to the situation. They wanted to further stoke tensions. So as far as I know, the Vatican has not opposed the National Constituent Assembly and actually has been attempting to play a constructive, I would say, role in mediating talks with the opposition and trying to defray tensions and avert possible civil war. Sure, the question is the parallel between 1973 Chile and Venezuela, and what is the role of the Venezuelan military right now? I think that this is it's an interesting parallel and has a lot to it. I think also a lot, where it doesn't fit. But I think that the key difference between Venezuela and Chile is that you have a military that is entirely staffed by officers belonging to the oligarchy, and you have a military which is largely segregated. The officer schools in Chile are closed to people of lower class backgrounds. It's very stratified. In Venezuela, you have traditionally had a much more popular, military in which you had, possibilities for people from lower class backgrounds to ascend in rank, with Chavez being a key example, but a number of others. And you just also have a different spirit within the military, definitely a more progressive nationalist spirit within the Venezuelan military that differs markedly with the Chilean military's, utterly reactionary, especially at that time, hysterically anti-communist posture, particularly on the top of its on the part of its top officers. And I think the other key issue is that in Venezuela you have the antecedent of the Caracaso massacre in 1989, where you had basically this popular revolt against neoliberal austerity measures that were implemented by the previous representative democracy, which really utterly delegitimized this democracy and led to its crisis, out of which rose Chavez. And the government responded to these protests and lootings with brute force. It brought in the army, and they massacred anywhere between something like 3,000, at least 3,000 people. They've only found some like 200 of those individuals, but mass graves, they've been unable to identify everyone. So the point is, at this moment, that this is, you have a military coup by Chavez led on February 4th, 1992, and you have another one in November. This really, Chavez had been organizing within the military with others, his movement for many years, and this really kind of solidifies the split within the military and the government, and the refusal on the part of these progressive nationalist sections of the military to participate in these absolutely bloody neoliberal austerity measures. So from that point on, the military aligns with the government, is actually a key ally, in thwarting the 2002 coup. That you see a number of generals refuse to cooperate with the high command in 2002, and you have the rank and file, are the ones who actually saved the day in a certain sense. Besides the masses of people who mobilize, it's the guards within Miraflores Palace, I'm sure as you all seen in The Revolution Will Not Be Televised, who actually arrest the leaders of the coup, etc. So there's definitely that. Fast forwarding today, Chavez also implements important doctrinal changes in the military. Venezuela is unique in that Venezuela is the only country which actually attempted to really, I think, transform its armed forces in a significant way. I don't know about Bolivia, but Venezuela is definitely unique in that sense, that you actually do have a Bolivarian socialist doctrine. And to the extent that I think that it's safe to say that the majority of the Venezuelan armed forces are still Chavista. That doesn't necessarily mean they're Madurista or they support Maduro, but they're definitely, you know, I think that they would be opposed to an opposition government. That being said, that the same cannot be said for the police. That, in fact, a friend of mine who works in the National Security University, which, you know, was originally created to promote police reform and train the police, has told me that some 60% of the CSP, which is the Special Investigative Police, of which Oscar Perez, who is a pilot with them, he carried out a helicopter terrorist attack. I think it was a month ago, it was June 27th. That, you know, basically he flew over the Supreme Court building and he flew over the Interior Ministry and he dropped grenades. And of course, The Guardian comes out, calls it a helicopter protest, interestingly. But he is an example of this kind of fascist tendency within elements of the police. My friend tells me some 60% of this special investigative body of this police force are right wing. And of the intelligence service, the equivalent of the FBI, the Sabine, something like 80%. And this is very scary because in the event of an opposition government, these apparatuses, would press themselves as willing accomplices and instruments of a right-wing repression. And, you know, we have to be conscious of this. To summarize that question is, how do we view the question of transition to capitalism and transition from capitalism to socialism in Venezuela and the errors of, perhaps the potential errors within that process? I guess to begin, I would say that, Hugo Chavez, that in terms of his, you're right that he did begin as a third way Democrat when he was elected, third way social Democrat. I mean, reading Anthony Giddens and, you know, basically, you know, a fan of Tony Blair in a certain sense. But I think that it's telling the way that he radicalizes, because it's the failure to implement these even modest social democratic reforms that radicalizes him. Because when he signs his 49 decrees in 2001, among them is the land reform law, you know, which is not really radical, but it is radical. It's extremely radical. But I mean, it doesn't end capitalism, but it's radical. These are resisted. These are met with, you know, life or death resistance from the oligarchy, and the coup is really a response to them. And it's the coup that radicalizes Chavez and convinces him of the impossibility of coming to any kind of negotiated social democratic, you know, modernization within Venezuela. And, you know, it's the lockout, the oil lockout of later that year that you know, further convinces him that, you know, of a need of a break with capitalism fundamentally. And Hugo Chavez was an avowed socialist. That being said, I think that it's important to note that, you know, Venezuela is not Cuba. And Venezuela is very, very, very different in many ways. And, you know, the distinct that Venezuela's process, you know, I think Salvador Allende in his conversations with Fidel, you know, I mean, Fidel, you know, recognized, you know, the Chilean, you know, road to socialism is legitimate and is right for Chile, as is the Cuban is right for Cuba. You know, this is, you know, every country has its own process. And Venezuela, you know, Chavez's strategy was a long-term electoral transition to socialism, you know, by building kind of a counter-hegemonic bloc and, you know, kind of using the country's oil wealth to build parallel structures and consolidate institutions of grassroots democracy. And this is unique in the world. This is a unique experience that never before have we seen a process of democratic socialist transition. I don't want to use the term democratic. Electoral socialist transition over such a long term in the midst of such sharp polarization and violence as in Venezuela. So this is entirely unprecedented. And we should be, I mean, Allende lasted 3 years. And I mean, that being said, of course, I agree with you in many ways. I mean, the many of the premises of this transition were erroneous. And the first one being that oil prices were going to stay high for a long period of time, in which you could use to finance this kind of slow counter-hegemonic kind of, you know, encroachment on the, you know, powers of the elites. And, you know, as such, you know, as in many progressive governments in Latin America, the high commodity prices were used in which you could, you know, the high tide raises all boats. You could increase, you know, social spending and improve the lot of the masses of people, which is absolutely necessary and a huge achievement. But you could also guarantee, you know, capital accumulation to keep going. And this was clearly something that was unsustainable and it was going to hit a point. And I think it'd be really interesting if Chavez was alive right now, because Venezuela is right now embarking on its own special period in which the price of oil is not going to increase. And foreseeably in the future or any stable way, and that Venezuela has to adapt and it has to radically transform its culture, its consumption patterns, its political institutions, everything. And, I think that, we should be critical of Maduro. I think he's made a lot of errors. And, he was faced with a pretty impossible situation, and we can hypothesize what Chavez would have done. I mean, I think his strike at the helm speech at the end, I think if he had been alive, I interpret the strike of the helm as kind of the same thing as, Mao's bombard the headquarters. It was the resounding cry before an offensive to repolarize and really to radicalize the class struggle. But unfortunately, it was too late. So we can't really, predict what would have happened.
Neil?
what is the role of the United States in destabilizing Venezuela and backing the opposition, destabilizing the economy, et cetera? I think that, to begin, we have to recognize that the opposition is largely funded by, the United States. I mean, we can imagine that the Russians were, we're in this Russian gate hysteria about, Trump's son-in-law get money from the Russians or whatever. The point is, you have a situation in Venezuela where all of the main opposition parties are funded by Washington. And in what other country would this be permitted? In the global north, this would never be permitted. But given that, this is the zone of not being in the south, in which these countries are not considered, they're considered barbarian lands, in which they're, the back door, the anything goes, whatever. There's a different set of norms that apply there as opposed to the United States. Ava Golinger has documented this. I mean, you can see her work online that she has shown through Freedom of Information Act request that, the opposition has received, has been funded to the tune of millions of dollars by the United States. In fact, the WikiLeaks cable shows this, a 2009 cable by Ambassador Browning shows that, basically during in the context of 2009 protests against the government, the State Department, I think it's the USAID Office of Transitions, which should reveal to you the goals of that office. They say, all the people protesting in the streets, I'm paraphrasing, are our grantees. I mean, they openly say this. So I mean, if you look at the student leaders who are being, support, they go to trainings, that somehow they have the money. I don't know where Lillian Tintori, Lopez's wife, gets the money to travel everywhere, but somehow she does. There's a complex operation of, financial, logistical, support to the opposition that extends to all levels and that we're not even conscious of. This is constant. U.S. intervention is structural. There, in terms of the economic question, that's more complex. That, like as I mentioned before, like there is clearly, and the U.S. backed opposition is obviously attempting to make the economy scream, like in Chile, for example. Julio Borges has been writing letters to the heads of international financial institutions, threatening them not to lend to Venezuela, so they don't support the dictatorship. In fact, when Goldman Sachs just bought up a certain amount of Venezuela bonds, as a certain, I guess, a lifeline to PDVSA, lifeline from the devil, I suppose. The opposition screamed bloody murder, is suddenly, the international financial, this bank is now the enemy and a promoter of dictatorship. It's insane. But, the same thing. So, clearly the opposition has been absolutely attempting to sabotage. Like I said, they have not been approving these agreements to establish joint ventures with the government. I mean, so these are all actions that I think Noam Chomsky says something very correct with regard to Israel-Palestine, that nothing that Israel does, it does without a U.S. green light. That every action is a U.S.-Israeli action in one way or another. And I wouldn't go to say that every action by the opposition is obviously they have autonomy, but in key respects, the fact that they've gone on the offensive in this way, they just received a huge signal from Washington, because they just said that Freddy Guevara, who is the leader of the far right wing of the Venezuelan opposition, he said, you can't force me to participate in regional elections. We're not going to participate. And he was motioning on to form a parallel government. And the head of the other more moderate opposition party, he slapped him down and said, you are irresponsible. And the United States just issued a statement saying they will not support any parallel government. So while they sanction Maduro and call him a dictator, they say that they will continue to dialogue with Venezuela, that the Venezuelan government is the only legitimate government with whom they dialogue. So clearly that's a signal to their own people that, we're not going to back you. We're not going to continue to back you. You need to, this insurrectionary way, if you failed, we're not going to continue to support you. But nonetheless, the economic destabilization continues in in a plethora of different ways in terms of the way that U.S. Basically, it's the almost all of the recipients of Venezuela's petrodollars, which basically Venezuela imports everything under the sun because it doesn't produce everything because it's an oil producer. So it gives away its petrodollars to private transnational companies, so they import things. What we've seen documented over the, Luis Gavasut, for example, has documented that the fourth recipient of government dollars in 2013 was Polar, was the largest, it's a transnational firm, has capital from Pepsi Cola. This is firmly linked within the machinery of global capitalism. This company receives massive amounts of money from the government in 2013 to produce corn flour and beer and other things. And suddenly, a few months later, there's no corn flour to be found in the country. What's happening there? I mean, that's clearly, but at the same time, it's the government that continues to give this money to the transnational corporations. So, I mean, that's something that has to be questioned and opposed as well. So, it's complex, but I think those are kind of the main contours of that. Is the example of the Cuban Revolution and, basically the question of, the role of, what is the role of the Venezuelan, working class in achieving a revolutionary transition, et cetera. So I think that, I do want to emphasize here that it's important that, to say again, Venezuela is not Cuba in the sense that, what is the working class in Venezuela? I mean, this is important to note that, 40% of Venezuela's workforce is in the informal sector. So this has, this is a consequence of 100 years of oil and how this has impacted every dimension of Venezuelan society. As a result, you just have a massive sector of the society that is excluded from, the formal sector. It basically engages in all kinds of activities from selling coffee on the street to crime. And this is how they survive. This is structural in Venezuela. And the question of socialism, I guess we can kind of talk about, the question of socialism, and I'm kind of going to link this to your question. The question of building, of Chavez's strategy for, socialism, you can't neglect this, the economic dimension of rentierism, of how do you get the country to produce? How do you get, and in fact, early on, Chavez's, proposal to form workers' cooperatives throughout the country early on was very interesting in this respect. But ultimately, this proposal was sabotaged by the very logic of underdevelopment because there simply was not in the population just not a lot of, the culture of rentierism of basically, there was not a culture of work in the sense that basically these cooperatives just ended up dissolving in which the money that was given to form them was just disappeared. And they didn't actually form sustainable cooperatives. I mean, because partly just there was not the discipline in the sense that you have a large industrial proletariat that is highly organized in labor unions and can, manage, can take over industry and manage it. Like, yes, you have key cases of that happening, and that's important. We have to highlight that, as I pointed out with the Kimberly-Clark factory, or like the workers in the Venezuelan state milk companies and dairy companies' resistance against right-wing attacks in the past few weeks. Like, these are examples of working class militancy in Venezuela. But the question in Venezuela is how do you transition to socialism? We have to rethink all of our paradigms here about what does transition to socialism mean, and in a country that does not have a formal organized working class, as in other countries in which basically the models of revolutionary transition are outlined. How do you do it? How do you face the problem when you have 40% of the workers who are in the formal sector? How do you create productive opportunities for how do you basically guarantee food security? They've created this youth program. It's called Plan Chamba Juvenil, like youth work program, in which they're trying to bring the youth into the countryside and do agriculture. That's one proposal. So, I guess the question of reform or revolution, I don't know if it's so clear. I think that it's clear in a sense that yes, you have to resist the reformist efforts that wish to, restore bourgeois hegemony. But in the sense that In Venezuela, there's no easy solutions. I mean, this is an extremely poor country, which the income just collapsed over the past few years. There's very few productive apparatuses. The country, to go to the indigenous question, one of the consequences of this is that they're beginning to massively expand extractivism in large sections of the country. And, for me, I find this absolutely detestable. Near the Amazon, in Bolivar State, a 112,000-kilometer stretch has been designated the mining arc, and which is being opened up to a handful of transnational companies under terms that have not been made public to engage in open-pit mining, which is going to be ecologically catastrophic. Certainly, government has ordered they can't use mercury in the mining, and 60% supposedly of all the revenues are going to go to social programs. I don't know, but the point is, I mean, this is abhorrent. And, the same thing they're doing coal mining, as you mentioned, they just opened up new mines on the border with Colombia. This is abhorrent, but how do we stand, what is Venezuela supposed to do in this? And for me, I detest it, but in light of the fact that Venezuela has $11 billion in its reserves and basically depends entirely, for imports on transnational capitalist companies, Polar and Pepsi Cola, et cetera, there's a shortage of medicines in the country. It needs to import medicines. What is it supposed to do to guarantee these things to the people? I mean, it's a complex question. I think the way they're going about it is absolutely unacceptable in not making it transparent and attempting to defend it as eco-socialist. But nonetheless, these are dilemmas. How do you govern from the left in an extremely poor, dependent capitalist country? It's an extremely serious problem, and I think Hugo Chavez had a lot of ideas about, attempting to do so, and I think that we need to go back and take him seriously as not just as a leader, but as a thinker, as a revolutionary thinker. And I don't have the space here to develop any of these points, but they're just hypotheses. And to move on, the question of I think I just combined a lot of questions into one. Why did Chavez not use the why did Chavez and Maduro not use the military to deal with food hoarding and food smuggling? I mean, this is a complex question because, in part, the military in Venezuela is unfortunately very much linked to a lot of corruption. So to the point that, the military controls the system of food imports into the country, and that, they scrape a lot off the top. There's a lot of import fraud in which they're complicit. So it's not just, the military is not just a revolutionary military. It's not like a people's army, or the Cuban Revolution or the Chinese Revolution that can just be used to carry out revolutionary changes. It's this very complex, amalgam of progressive forces, but also just, reactionary forces and just corruption. And it's a serious problem. There are no easy answers. I don't come here with easy answers. The other question is about, I did want to return to the question about the Venezuelan road to socialism versus the Cuban road. That I do think that everyone should really read George Chicorello's book, We Created Chavez, because it kind of contextualizes why Chavez, where Chavismo came from and why the Venezuelan road to socialism took the characteristics that it took. And you have to understand it in light of the failed guerrilla struggle of the 1960s and 70s in Venezuela, and basically the Venezuelan left, which was deeply embedded among, the popular sectors, among labor unions and others in the 1940s, and the struggle against the dictatorship in the 40s and 50s, ultimately took to the, following the Cuban model, they left the cities and they took where the majority of the population lives, and they took to the countryside, totally isolating themselves, engaging this totally failed, both in political and military terms, guerrilla struggle, and they were defeated. And it was only, George Chicorello's argument is that it was these defeated cadres who returned to the barrios and began to plant their roots once again among the masses of people that from there you start to see the revolutionary organizations that have brought us the Bolivarian Revolution. For example, Chavez's brother, Adán Chávez, was a militant in the party of the Venezuelan Revolution, which grew out of the guerrilla struggle. So Chavez was directly linked to that. You also asked can you talk more about the composition of the sectoral representatives within the Venezuelan National Assembly? And I think this is interesting because, like I said before, this is different from the 1999 process. That this is entirely new. That they're deciding to basically I would say it's kind of affirmative action to recognize certain sectors of the population. Like I said, you know, the workers, campesinos and fishermen, communes and communal councils, people with disabilities, pensioners, and business people. So this is definitely a means of trying to prioritize the demands of certain sectors, and I think that it's defensible on those grounds, and I think it's important, though I would definitely have revised the sectors included in that. I think that women should have been included, as you know, so should have LGBT people, but unfortunately they were not. They were not. Though, I mean, they have said that, Maduro said that the representation was going to be at least half women or more than half women. I don't know if that actually, I haven't seen the results of that bared out. But, I mean, that was the idea. So I think it's an interesting way to prioritize the demands of certain groups. I mean, I think it was also part of an electoral strategy to kind of over-represent Chavismo in a certain way, though not that it mattered because the opposition boycotted. Lastly, before we get to take more questions, the example you kind of asked about examples of in Venezuela historically of kind of processes of constructing hegemony, of winning people over who don't necessarily agree with you. And I think that the Constituent Assembly is an example of this in a way that Chavismo Bravillo was. As I said, this defiant Chavismo was the reason, and Maduro paid tribute to it on the night of the victory, as this is the reason why we won. This actually succeeded in mobilizing a lot of people who were just utterly disenchanted, people who had become disenchanted with the government and, you know, needed to be re-enamored with the process. And, you know, by presenting these grassroots these candidates and presenting these very interesting proposals that could have a real impact on people's lives, people were won back to the process. And I think that explains this, you know, the fact that Chavismo was able to win back, according to these figures, something like 2 million votes. Because keep in mind that since 2012, Chavismo has bled nearly 3 million votes, because Chavez had won like 8,100,000 votes in October 2012. Maduro won 7.5 million, and then the Chavistas won 5 million in the National Assembly elections in December 2015. So that's about 3 million votes that they lost. And they're able to definitely win back 2 million, at least 2 million of those votes, which is, you know, a huge gain, and I think it speaks to the success of that campaign. First question, yeah, is can you explain more about the plebiscite? Was it binding? What were the three questions? And yes, you're right, I did not explain it very well at all. The first question was, do you reject or recognize the Constituent Assembly? The second was, what is the role demanded of the functionaries and the National Armed Forces in restoring the constitutional order? And the last one was, do you back the renovation of public powers, the confirmation of a unity government, the holding of free and transparent elections within the Constitution? Which, in other words, is basically, do you back a, you know, immediate presidential elections to establish a, you know, a unity government, being a neoliberal government's going to implement austerity measures. I mean, that's what, in their language, that's what that would be. In terms of...
By using the word transparency, they're kind of disguising.
Exactly.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, that's completely the case. And if this is actually the case, that the far right of the opposition actually had called for the formation of a parallel government, which, you know, as I mentioned before, the United States has totally vetoed, and the more moderate elements of the opposition. I shouldn't even use the term moderate, because they're equally violent and vicious, but nonetheless, they're more they're less avaricious, and they can wait a little bit longer. It's not a binding. The plebiscite was not binding. It was presented as, like, you know, basically, this is the voice of the people of Venezuela. This is the democratic mandate. And outside of the bounds of the institutions, which are seen as obviously dictatorial, according to the mainstream media. So that was the kind of the way that was presented by the media. And, of course, none of the media questioned this, quote, the mythical 7.4 million, you know, vote figure for the plebiscite, whereas, you know, no one is accepting the 8 million figure. No international media outlet is accepting the 8 million figure that the government, the CNE, has released.
Do you have the totals for and against each?
No, the thing, what a friend of mine who used to work in the CNE told me, his hypothesis is that they actually tabulated each question separately and they added them up. So you have to divide it by three to get the real number of people who voted in it. In fact, I was on Margarita Island in Nueva Esparta during the day of that referendum, and there was not a lot of people out there. So I think, and it was mostly upper class, you know, white people who voted for it. In any case, the you know, they burnt the ballot, so it's impossible to do any audit. So we have no idea. Convenient. Yes, the opposition burnt the ballots. Exactly. So I guess I'm going to merge the two questions into one of, you know, what happened to the militias, and we'll start with that question. There is a Bolivarian militia in Venezuela. The thing is, it's not an independent entity that's necessarily like subordinated to local communities. It is integrated within the existing military structure. So, I mean, it's ultimately under the purview of the Ministry of Defense in that sense, but nonetheless, it still exists. And, I mean, you can go anywhere you go in Caracas and you can see these, you know, volunteers, and, you know, they're very proud and they have their uniforms, and many of them are just like older people who have gone through the training because they, you know, they feel, you know, this is the opportunity for them to, you know, defend the process. So, I mean, so I think that, you know, that should be clearly the popular militia is, you know, one of the opposition has decried this and the media has decried this. Oh, these, you know, Maduro's armed enforcers, these, you know, these militia, these goon squads that are throughout the country. And I mean, that's really not, I mean, they don't even participate in any kind of law enforcement or any way. They just are there in the case that there would be any kind of subversive activity, in the case that, I don't know, the United States were to intervene in a serious way, or you'd actually see a real attempt by the opposition to take power by force. I mean, the idea is these could be counted upon to defend their communities. Though I think what is more interesting is the popular defense committees that are beginning to emerge in places like Barinas. That, you know, you saw a convoy of these within these. Barinas has been the scene of intense opposition violence, particularly in May. And you're beginning to see among the communes there and among the popular organizations are beginning to arm themselves and engage in kind of these convoys to, you know, basically show their strength in the face of the right-wing terror. So that's definitely interesting. I wouldn't say that it's generalized, but there are, it's like what I said with the increasing worker militancy in some areas. It's not generalized, but there are promising signs. What is also should be taken into account that there's the other favorite trope of the international media, which are the feared colectivos, which are, you know, so according to the media, are these, you know, these goon squads of from the government who go around on motorcycles killing people, killing protesters. And in reality, colectivos in many cases are armed revolutionary organizations within barrios like 23 de Enero in Caracas, which is a historically revolutionary neighborhood, which, you know, basically they have paramilitary structures, but they're often They're revolutionary collectives. They have an armed wing, but they're also, for example, in the case of Alexis Vives, which is like a national political organization, but they have an armed wing within this one neighborhood, 23 de Enero, but they also have a commune. So they have bakeries, they have different productive entities that are operating within that, and they fielded candidates in the National Constituent Assembly. So the colectivos continue to be. What people have, you know, told me is that, you know, the government wants to give in, but it's the it's the colectivos, it's the militancy from below that's not going to let them, because they know that if the government turns over, I mean, there's a real threat of civil war, because if the opposition were to come to power and attempt to, you know, basically the first thing they would have to do would be disarm all of these groups, and it would be extremely violent and bloody, and like these organizations, you know, the barrios are not going to simply roll over and allow the opposition to do the same thing that they're doing in Brazil and other countries. So, I mean, again, this is very dangerous and worrisome. It needs to be. I mean, I don't think we should all glamorize the kind of bloodshed that would result from the situation. And there should be ways to continue the revolutionary transition without having that happen. To move on to your question about how are people organizing, how are the masses of people, or how is the government playing a role in continuing to organize the masses of people? I think that it should be pointed out that the missions largely, we have to give a very quickly, the missions began as kind of grassroots, informal, ad hoc solutions to these problems. So, and they were largely on the initiative of the grassroots. And for example, the Cuban doctors, when they came to Venezuela, they originally stayed in the houses of just ordinary Venezuelans. They were integrated with the community. They provide health care. You had committees of water and all kinds of different popular organization. There was a absolute effervescence of popular organization in those early years. As is in many cases with most revolutions, this kind of organization kind of dies down and ultimately sometimes gets institutionalized and bureaucratized. And these missions have largely been bureaucratized, in which they're not the kinds of instances of grassroots democracy that they were before. They're largely government institutions that carry out services, sometimes efficiently, a lot of the time not efficiently. The problem that is facing the revolution at this point from the government, that you have seen this process of bureaucratic corrosion that has made, as I said in the beginning, this distance between the high levels of the government, the upper echelons of the government and the party and the mass of people has become so great that they literally, that they have not gone to the barrios in a very long time. They have not, Chavez in Strike on the Helm in his final speech, he said, it would be great. You ministers should go spend a few nights in a barrio. Why aren't you doing this? Why have you disconnected yourself from the people? And he chastised them, in fact, a very harsh way about that. So there clearly is this extreme gap that needs to be overcome. And it remains to be seen if that can be done within the context of the Socialist Party, which is itself was born a deformity. It was born a monstrosity because it was the leadership of the party. They basically made all the leaders of all the existing public officials, the governors, there were many cases just opportunists, they made them leaders of the party just for being in the government. So, basically you have the worst kind of situation. In revolutionary Russia, the party, basically the leaders of the party became the bureaucrats that basically managed the state capitalism in Russia. Venezuela, you had the bureaucrats who became the leaders of the party. So it was a very unfortunate situation. So I don't really see the PSUV as necessarily being a revolutionary instrument. And I think the vast majority of the Venezuelan left does not really see the PSUV as being a revolutionary party in any way. It's a pluriclass party, and it's very mildly reformist. Though what is interesting is the self-organization that is happening is, I think, in one key instance, are the communes. The communes are basically... In 2006, Chavez signed a law to create, the National Assembly approved a law which Chavez signed to create communal councils, in which basically there are organs of grassroots democracy in which citizens come together, they elect a certain spokespeople, not representative spokespeople, who can decide on municipal matters, and they have, legal authority to approve a whole lot of different things. And they actually can receive money from the government to carry out different projects. So basically a conglomerate of these communal councils forms a commune. And the idea is that Chavez's vision of the communal state is that these kinds of popular organs of grassroots power, that they not only exercise political and administrative power, but also are develop economic socially in Venezuela. Socially run enterprises, socially productive enterprises. So they're basically owned by the commune, they're either cooperatives or they're owned directly by the community, and they produce in places like Barinas, in places like Merida, in places like Lara State, you actually have cheese production and cattle production and a lot of interesting things going on. But you also have fascinating self-organization that's going there. And really, this is the project. Chavez's vision of the communal state is that these organs of self-government are going to subsume the existing bourgeois state apparatus and be able to govern themselves. And I mean, obviously, we're a very long way from that. And the capacity of these institutions is very limited still. But nonetheless, this is, and I mean, George Ciccariello Mayer has a book, Building the Commune, which I think is a great introduction to all this process. And I mean, this is really, I think, the horizon, the emancipatory horizon in Venezuela, that you can really build the commune as a institution that can replace the bourgeois state and continue the struggle for socialism. So that's one dimension of that. Lastly, to refer to, I think you're absolutely right. When I use the term middle class, I'm using it in a Venezuelan context and not a U.S. context. We have to understand, well, class, as in the United States, but particularly in Venezuela and Latin America, is a profoundly racialized term. So that in Venezuela, the middle class, the upper middle class, is, you know, largely segregated from the population. They live in, you know, basically apartment complexes that often are gated communities. They tend to be whiter. They tend to often be of European stock, European immigrants, Portuguese, Italians who immigrated in the 1940s and 50s. They have a aspirational class, you know, ideology where they seek to ascend. They have nothing but contempt for the people who, for the, you know, the black and brown people who largely live in the barrios of Venezuela, which are, you know, the shanty towns where people construct their own homes, where, you know, they're overflowing. They're historically have not been access to services. Now, thanks to the revolution and many of these barrios, you actually do have electricity and Wi-Fi and appliances and gas and all kinds of things that you didn't have before. And, you know, that's an important indication for why the barrios have not risen up against the government. Because, to be clear, if the barrios were to rise up, the government would fall tomorrow or tonight. As we saw in 2002, if the people decide to take to the streets, there's no government that can stay in power, especially in Venezuela. So this is an important distinction to clarify.
Okay. I just want to repeat again that I have to pay for someone to be here while we're having this meeting. I have to pay for the hall, and I paid for his airplane ticket to come here, so if any of you want to make a donation to help, I'd like it. Any more questions?
Obama designated Venezuela as a national security threat to the United States. Seems sort of ludicrous, but I understand it had significant impact economically because of provisions that go with that declaration and how they affect access to credit on the global market. Can you address that and expand on it if it's a significant player in the crisis that currently is underway?
I was listening to a speech by Bruce Cummings about North Korea. There's a conference in June, and in that speech he said that every country that the U.S. has declared a threat to its national security has been invaded by the U.S. and overthrown, except for Cuba.
It's very true. So the question was, what is the role of the Obama decree for declaring Venezuela an unusual and extraordinary threat to U.S. national security and basically in influencing decisions of international financial institutions not to lend to Venezuela? I think that Telesur had a very interesting report a few late last year where they interviewed Francisco Rodriguez, who is no Chavista. He is the head of Torino Capital. He's a former Bank of America Merrill Lynch chief economist. This is not a radical guy, but he openly said that, you know, basically that the Obama decree had a direct impact on discouraging entities, of banks from lending to Venezuela. For example, we see the unprecedented case of Citgo. Citigroup. Citigroup was Venezuela's bond agent, which was the charge with holding Venezuela's account through which it pays its bondholders. Citgo last summer not only resigned from its post, which, you know, you can do, but refused to continue to carry out its obligations, which is unprecedented. You don't do that in business when you have a contract. He cited that as an example of the fact that there is a financial embargo against Venezuela. There's a blockade. And this is going back to the question about the same thing we're seeing with the National Assembly head, Julio Borges, writing letters to international banks not to invest in Venezuela, that this is clearly deliberate, and part of it is deliberate, and as an attempt to strangle Venezuela, and part of it is just this rational economic activity that they're just responding to heightened risk, so they choose not to invest in Venezuela. The other key thing is, why are Venezuelan bonds? Why does Venezuela have so much trouble basically doing a bond swap so it doesn't have to pay so much on its bond payments? Why are the risk rating on Venezuelan bonds so high when Venezuela is an oil producer that, you know, basically has never defaulted and pays back all of its loans over the past, or under Chavismo, has paid all of its, you know, massive debt obligations. And, you know, this is clearly politically motivated, that Venezuelan bonds are being rated with extremely high risk as opposed to, you know, bonds in other countries. Yeah, and I guess to return to the first point is, well, why does a country like Saudi Arabia, which is also being hit hard by this global collapse of oil prices, or a country like Nigeria, which is likewise extremely dependent upon oil, why are they not experiencing the same type of crisis in Venezuela? Yes, you can say that the Chavista government should have put more in the reserves and they should have had a rainy day fund. And that's absolutely the case. But nonetheless, Saudi Arabia, Nigeria, all these other oil producers can count on an international credit line to, you know, weather the crisis. And there's no doubt about that.
And they're democracies, right?
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
I guess we...
Well, thank you so much for coming. I really appreciate it for the time.